A little hidden history, a little pedagogy, a lot of ways we can improve our teaching and mindset so that our history and social studies classrooms tell a more complete, diverse human story. I'm Cheryl Ann Amendola, and this is the Teaching History Her Way podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Teaching History Her Way podcast. My name is Cheryl Ann Amendola, and I am your host, and I'm so happy to be here with you, either riding in the car or listening while you're exercising or on your walk today or whatever it is that you're doing while you're enjoying the Teaching History Her Way podcast. Just so we can get started with you getting in touch with me, if you really want to, you can find me on Twitter at History Her Way or on Instagram at Teaching History Her Way. I am very, very, very excited about tonight's interview because I've been looking forward to it for a really long time. Linda Monk, the Constitution Lady, is on with me today, and I don't know if you know her work. If you don't, you should. Totally useful in the classroom, really wonderful to listen to, and makes the Constitution and all things about it understandable for everyone, which is really, really helpful to me as a teacher and as a citizen. So Linda Monk, JD, is a constitutional scholar, journalist, and nationally award-winning author. A graduate of Harvard Law School, she twice received the American Bar Association's Silver Gavel Award, its highest honor for public education about the law. Her books include The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution, Ordinary Americans, U.S. History Through the Eyes of Everyday People, and The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. For more than 25 years, Ms. Monk has written commentary for newspapers nationwide, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and Huffington Post. I could go on and on about all of her accomplishments and how wonderful she is, but I'd like for her to get started talking and say hi. Hi, Linda. Thank you so much for coming today.
Hi, Cheryl Ann. It's an honor to be invited and especially to connect with your wonderful audience.
As a teacher, I love having your books in my classroom. So make sure that if you're listening, you check out the show notes so that you can go and purchase all of them because they're so useful. I particularly like your one about the Bill of Rights because the kids always have a lot of questions about what each one of them means and how they should be interpreted because there's a lot to understand.
There is a lot to understand. And in fact, one of my goals in writing, it started with the Bill of Rights book, that was my first book, was to take everything that I learned in Harvard Law School, but to make it understandable for everyday citizens. And I'm proud to say that there are judges who love that book, and there are eighth graders who love that book. So I'm really honored that it's received such a wide audience. And please come to my website, www.lindamonk.com, and you can check out some samples of the books.
It really is fabulous. And I have some of those eighth graders that love Linda's book. So if you can get a middle schooler to be into your book, you've done something right.
I appreciate that. Now, if we could just get the adults to read the book, you know?
It should be required of every citizen to read it.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm just joking, but there's been a wide adult audience for it. Some have suggested maybe it should be mandatory reading for our elected representatives. And I would concur with that.
I'm with you on that one, too. So today, Linda wanted to talk with me, and I wanted to talk with her about James Madison and his involvement in the founding of our country and the writing of the U.S. Constitution. And when Linda and I were getting ready for this, I was talking to her about how really my base of knowledge about James Madison is through his friendship with Thomas Jefferson, because I've done so much studying about Thomas Jefferson. And every time you read about him, you read about his best friend forever, James Madison. So I'm excited that we're dedicating our time to Madison.
So am I, too, because between you and me, TJ did little Jimmy wrong. Now, let me start out by saying, you know, we're celebrating Constitution Day, so I want to flag that and certainly Madison's role there. But if we're going to do a little spilling the tea on the side, Jefferson was in charge of fixing Madison up, which might have become his only wife. And TJ, of course, flirted so bad that she turned Madison down. But all worked out because I think Dolly Madison was a better match for him ultimately anyway. But you know, TJ could be a sly fellow, and Madison was good, blue, true, loyal. What I like about Madison and why I guess he's my favorite founder, two things. One is he could change his mind. You know, and some people now will say, oh, well, Madison flip-flopped. First he was against the Bill of Rights, then he was for the Bill of Rights. And I say, no, he didn't flip-flop at all. He considered all the evidence. He understood that the people wanted a Bill of Rights in order to support the Constitution. And he said in a letter to one of his friends that I'm an honest man. He was an honest man. I think he had, he was up there with Washington in terms of personal integrity. That doesn't mean he didn't make mistakes, big mistakes, like being a slaveholder. But I also believe he had great personal and political integrity. And that's my second reason that he's my favorite of the founders, is because he's both a philosophical genius. I mean, I don't think anyone would say, with the possible exception of Hamilton, but we all know how Hamilton was a little overbroad on his modesty. So that Madison was the genius. But on the other hand, he was also a practical politician and he knew what needed to be done to get things done, and he would do it.
I know the takeaway from that conversation was not that Thomas Jefferson was the one that made Katie Floyd break up with James Madison, but I didn't know that.
Yes. Inquiring minds must know. Well, Katie Floyd, was she the very, very first one?
Think so. She's
I
the
think so. It
Yeah.
was whichever one Jefferson and Special Research Project, do get back to us about, but I know it was, if not Katie Floyd, it was whoever was the one that Jefferson was supposed to be doing the introductions for. It went awry, and it was definitely Jefferson's fault.
Man, that's so
But I
awesome.
will give this to TJ. Of course, he's the one who really persuaded Madison after the Constitutional Convention that a Bill of Rights was important. Remember, TJ is the one who says a Bill of Rights is what every person is entitled to and what no just government should rest on inference.
And they have so many letters going back and forth because, of course, Jefferson
Yeah.
was in Paris when all of this was going down. And they have quite a lot of correspondence, which is a great thing for teachers like us to dig into so that we can get to know their thoughts and get to know their relationship. Because one of the coolest things about my job is that you get to know these people so well based on what you read about them and what they wrote, that you can introduce them as actual
Right.
real life people.
Yeah, and that was part of the fun part of putting together my Bill of Rights book, was including those sidebars. I think I call it Letters of Liberty, that correspondence between Madison and Jefferson, and where Madison starts out saying, you know, a Bill of Rights is a parchment barrier. And then Jefferson's the one that says, well, you put it in the hands of an independent judiciary, and then it will have more effect. Of course, we know when Jefferson actually becomes president, he's not so fond of the independent judiciary. But it just goes to show that all of these pieces of our system work together, and hopefully in a way that's going to preserve our liberty over the long haul.
So, I want to talk about Madison as related. I guess we'll start with the Constitution and we'll go chronologically. He's called the father of the Constitution, and that's how most of us teach him. And also, I love that you two call him Little Jimmy because that's what I call him.
Yeah, it was an endearment. It was not disparaging. It was an endearment, although of course we wouldn't call him that to his face. Jimmy with a G. Jimmy, not Jimmy,
Little
like we'd
Jimmy.
say today. But anyway, I'm putting too fine a point on it. Go ahead.
No, I think
What
that's
about
perfect.
today?
I wanted to know why do we call him that? I know we teach him as the guy who took the notes, But why do we really call him the father of the Constitution? What makes him the guy?
Well, and as you know, he took exception to that. It came on that title, nickname, came in much later in his life, probably, I think it was only like 10 years or so before he died, in correspondence. And Madison replies, you know, you do me much injustice to call me the father of the Constitution. This was not like something sprung from Minerva. You know, they're talking about when Minerva sprung from Zeus's head. And from one head, he said, it's the product of many heads and many hands. So he took exception to that. I think there's two reasons. One is that he lived the longest of the framers. So he, and he eventually publishes his notes. But he was really, it was president, well, he wasn't president at that time, but General Washington, who was the spearhead of, we've got to have a new form of government, Alexander Hamilton and Madison helped. But there's no question that if Washington wasn't behind it, it wouldn't have succeeded. So Washington's really the indispensable man on the Constitution. But then in terms of it getting enacted, both written and ratified, and then, of course, becoming the first president. But Madison is essentially his right-hand man on the drafting. He gives Madison the task ahead of time to do the studying, come up with the plan. Madison does come up with the Virginia plan that's then presented by the governor of Virginia. It's not presented by Washington himself because he's elected chairman, and he keeps a neutrality, doesn't really speak much at all. So I think there are multiple factors, but it is a title that comes later in life. And interestingly enough, Professor Akhil Reed Amar of Yale Law School recently spoke to the James Madison Foundation scholars, teachers that are selected for graduate studies. And he was dissing Madison a lot. Now, I think it was maybe a little bit of savvy PR on Professor Amar's part. But he was saying, well, you know, Madison really didn't do all that much when you think of it, because bicameral legislature, most states had bicameral legislatures. He kind of, certainly when it comes to the Bill of Rights, he cut some pace from other Declaration of Rights. But that's not a fault. That's a strength. It means he knows how to create political consensus. So there's no question he's the workhorse of the Constitutional Convention, of getting the Bill of Rights, and even of the first administration. I mean, can you imagine the egos between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton? And here's Madison. He's writing Washington's first address to Congress, writing, he's in Congress himself, writing Congress's reply, and then he's writing for Washington, Washington's reply to Congress's reply. So if he wasn't the indispensable man, he was the indispensable writer and the worker horse, the workhorse. And I admire him immensely because of that, and because of his, the other thing is his strong stance on freedom of conscience. And he and Jefferson share that. But Madison gets it written into the First Amendment. And that's, you know, of all the things our nation shall be known for, it was the first nation to really have liberty of conscience in the national government, that you didn't have to have religious tests for public office. And Madison was a strong separationist, separation of church and state. Jefferson was, and so am I.
His original ideas about freedom of conscience, he worked with Jefferson on the Virginia Declaration of Rights, didn't he?
Exactly. Well, he worked with George Mason on the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And that's, We forget about 1776. He's in the Virginia House of Burgesses when they're coming up with their first state constitution, because they are the first state to declare independence in May of 1776. And they issue a constitution with a Declaration of Rights at the beginning. And George Mason is rightly celebrated as the author, but he had Madison's help. And so that's why when Madison himself is in Congress in 1789 under the first constitution, under our constitution of 1789, he is the one who drafts the Bill of Rights, our Bill of Rights, becomes our Bill of Rights, and, almost cuts and pastes from the Virginia Declaration of Rights, because it was a popular version.
And in that same vein, he also worked on the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom to make sure that Virginia actually passed that.
There you go, because Jefferson had drafted it, and Jefferson, as you know, on his tombstone, that's one of three things he claims credit for. The others did the Declaration of Independence and being president or founder of the University of Virginia. But I think you really can't understand Madison until you know what a great advocate for religious liberty he was, and particularly on behalf of the Baptists of Virginia, who were much discriminated against because Virginia had the established church of what today is the Episcopal Church, what before the Revolution was the Church of England, where you had to have a license from the king to preach, and Baptists would not go along with that.
All right, I want to change direction just a little bit. Not that I don't think that religious freedom is important, because I do, and that actually helps lead us into the Bill of Rights. So Madison originally didn't want one of those. He thought that the Constitution could be passed the way the Constitution was passed. I often have my students read Federalist 51 and try to have them explain what he's talking about, which is a really good exercise in patience. The Federalist Papers are a very good exercise in patience for our students. But what were Madison's original thoughts on a Bill of Rights? Why didn't he want one?
Well, I think actually his letter to Jefferson that's excerpted in my book in 1789 is a better summary. No diss to the, 1787. What am I saying? 1787 is a better summary, because it boils down to Madison's very clear about political efficacy. And, we hear about parchment barriers before. Well, Madison came up with that title, parchment barrier, meaning just because you put rights on paper, does that mean that they have any effect? And in Madison's time, just as today, the fact that we have a constitution written on paper in the National Archives, or the Bill of Rights also in the National Archives, the fact that it's on paper is not what puts it into effect. It's that the people and the institutions of our government give it effect. So Madison, he said that, in Virginia, and he cites Virginia, he said, "I've seen countless usurpations by the majority." And he was very concerned about the actions of a tyrannical majority in violation of the Bill of Rights.
So he's worried about the majority making bad decisions, or a wrong kind of majority who tries to do the wrong thing for the people. Is he also worried at all about state legislatures?
Well, you hear that a lot. You hear that, what the framers said, or many of the framers said, the reason for the Constitution itself was what was called an excess of democracy in the state legislatures. And what they were concerned about was the state legislatures passing laws that would help debtors. Because let's remember, at this time, a lot of those debtors were unpaid veterans of the American Revolution. because the under the Constitution, the national government didn't have the power to tax and to get revenue without the state's permission. And surprise, surprise, states didn't want to pay their bills. And so you had these people who had sacrificed everything for the American Revolution, and their farms were getting repossessed because of they didn't have the money to pay really a lot of it high taxes on their farms that were then passed because of merchants in the coastal areas. In Boston, it was, excuse me, in Massachusetts, it was Shays' Rebellion versus the Boston merchants. So there was a lot of upheaval because of that.
We talk a lot about Shays' Rebellion as a catalyst for the Constitutional Convention and the Constitution. And what role did property rights have to play in all of this, if any?
Well, no, I mean, certainly the as I said before, the framers' concern about excess democracy was the concern that through the legislative branch, the state governments were going to exercise, or excuse me, pass legislation to help those aggrieved debtors who, as I point out again, were veterans of the Revolutionary War. And remember, there's a lot of economic upheaval after the Revolutionary War, as there tends to be after most wars. So there definitely was the issue, and it's been, depending on who the scholar, they'll think it's more or less of an issue of having a stronger national government to protect private property. It is also true that the issue is having a stronger national government to keep England away, because we know it doesn't really go anywhere. It just kind of hovers offshore and then comes back in 1812. France is still, I mean, the infant nation has no real idea. You have 12, or excuse me, 13 brothers and sisters arguing about, well, no, I'm going to receive the minister from France. Oh, no, well, I'm going to receive the minister from France. And there was no stability, and that hurts the poor farmers as much as it hurts the more wealthy financiers.
So in the beginning of our interview, you had said that Madison is a man who could change his mind, which is part of why you like him so much. At what point does Madison reach the idea that a written Bill of Rights is necessary to protect the rights of the individual?
Well, he's does a response, and tweet me on this tomorrow, and I'll give you the exact citation. But it's in response to a letter from a friend in late August of 1789, where he's waiting for the Bill of Rights to be passed by Congress. Remember, he has to be edited, and he has to go through revisions on the Bill of Rights. And he says then what changed his mind was he ran for Congress from Virginia. Now, you know, he wanted to be in the Senate. You know, Madison wanted to be in the first U.S. Senate. But after he took a stand against Patrick Henry in the Virginia Ratifying Convention for the Constitution, Patrick Henry wasn't going to let him become a senator. As you know, the legislatures chose it then. So backing up, what he says in that letter to the friend is, again, I'm an honest man. I promised the voters of Virginia that I would support a Bill of Rights. He said, I was never against it per se, in the sense of I just think a Bill of Rights is a horrible, bad idea and I'll never, ever, ever change. What he did say was that what he said is, you know, I didn't think it was necessary, but it to give comfort to the people, the new citizens under this new constitution know that we will be responsive to them. That was, you know, at that point he was a Federalist. He was telling his fellow Federalists, it better come from us, because if it doesn't come from us, people will say we're just as bad as they thought we were, that we won't act to respond to the people.
Was James Madison the only, I guess we'll call him framer at this point. Was he the only framer that was that responsive to the people? Because I know lots of the people who wanted a Bill of Rights were thinking about what they wanted, and the people who did not think one was necessary were thinking about what they wanted, and a lot of them were philosophizing, and you can read their thoughts. Is Madison the only one who was able to really look at evidence and change his mind when he thought it was necessary?
Well, and act on it. I like to say, I used to say, you know, Madison was the Rodney Dangerfield of founding fathers. He were framers. He didn't get any respect. Now, generationally, a lot of people don't even know who Rodney Dangerfield was, so let that go. But he was getting it from both sides. George Mason, who was the one who makes the motion for to add a Bill of Rights at the Constitutional Convention, and it's defeated, and says he will cut off his right hand before he signs the Constitution as it is, and that includes, you know, not having a Bill of Rights, is, you'd think he'd be happy Madison is proposing amendments, right? He says, no, they're like water gruel. And they're not going to accomplish anything. What Mason is becoming clearer about saying is that they need structural change, not just what we think of a list of rights. And that was the critique of the Bill of Rights from the Federalists to start with. Oh, the Anti-Federalists don't really want a Bill of Rights. They really want to get at the constitutional powers and a strong national government. So everybody was accusing everybody of poor motives. Madison was getting it from his fellow Federalists, but he kept going. And that's why I admire him so much. He was the bulldog. He got it done. And one thing I want to add that I don't think most people are aware of, and I certainly wasn't aware of until I wrote my Bill of Rights book. While Madison is trying to get Congress in June to start acting on a Bill of Rights, New York and Virginia both are starting to hear proposals for us to have a second constitutional convention. And that was a big impetus for Madison. And he says that in his remarks. It's like, if we don't get going and get this Bill of Rights done, they're going to have another constitutional convention, and maybe they'll throw this out. The states will have another constitutional convention. Maybe they'll throw this out just like we threw out the Articles of Confederation. Everything was so contingent. And I think we don't appreciate that fully.
Well, when we look backwards, a lot of times we think about history as being inevitable. I know I'm guilty of it sometimes. I'm a lot more aware of it now. But our students often just kind of march through time where they think that everything was a guarantee and everything was supposed to happen, where as history teachers, we really need to fight that and say, no, there was no guarantee. We know because we are looking backward, but there was a lot of fear and anxiety during this time because nobody knew what was going to happen to the new United States. Nobody knew what was going to happen at the Constitutional Convention or what would happen afterwards.
Right. And certainly Washington himself made comments to that effect. Benjamin Franklin said, well, you know, we think we've done a good job, but the only thing certain in life is death and taxes. He made that remark in regards to the Constitution. So, yeah, it was contingent. We think of it as, we've heard it referred to as an experiment. It was said then. And it's obviously true today. We live in contingent times today. We don't know how it's going to turn out.
No, and I would hate to play on students' anxiety with that, but if any of them are anxious about what is happening in our current news cycle or with any of the latest Supreme Court decisions, I mean, their feelings of uncertainty can mimic or are like what people were feeling back then because they just didn't know. And a lot of them were just scared.
Right. Right. And, you know, again, not to diminish the things that students are confronting that I didn't have to confront in my lifetime, a lot about a global pandemic, But certainly the framers' generation did. I mean, smallpox was a scourge. With being caught in a global scenario where you don't know exactly what's going to unfold. So as Thomas Paine said, you know, these are the times that try men's souls. In my generation, it was about nuclear weapons and the Vietnam War. And of course, racial segregation and the desegregation of schools, the civil rights movement, the abhorrent violence against African Americans. And that is certainly one area, important area, where I salute Montpelier, the home of James Madison, where they've been coming to terms and grappling with and trying to work with the descendants of the enslaved people at Montpelier. There were over 300 people who were held as slaves under the Madison family. And Montpelier today is doing a wonderful job of trying to literally excavate that history. And so when we talk about Madison, and I talk about him as my favorite framer, it is not at all dismissing or diminishing the fact that he was and always was a slaveholder. And what I want to also note is that Alexander Hamilton's family came from great slaveholding wealth, that he married into the Schuyler family, came from great slaveholding wealth, that New York was a slaveholding society until 1800, at least, and capitalized from all the loans that were given based on using enslaved people as security for loans, that slavery was, and to some respects, as we're discovering today, continues to be a national epidemic in terms of the fallout from that, the consequences of that. So yes, we have to acknowledge, be clear about, condemn Madison's role as a slaveholder. And we also have to condemn Alexander Hamilton's role as someone who his family immensely profited from slavery. And we believe there's evidence that he held some people enslaved too, not to the extent that a Southern landowner in a plantation economy would have, but it's important. It's important to acknowledge how slavery infected the entire United States and the enormous economic benefits that were derived from the labor of enslaved people all across the country.
It's often surprising to my students that Alexander Hamilton was involved with enslavement, because they're all familiar with Alexander Hamilton from the musical.
Right.
They are often shocked. We started reading about New York's involvement in enslavement, and they're often absolutely shocked about how many places you can walk downtown that demonstrate both enslavement and the fallout from enslavement. And what a lot of times what I do in my classes when we're looking at what our founders and framers wrote, founding mothers, founding fathers, every founder in between, is we look at who they are and what they looked like and what their families were like, what their economy was like. And then we try to find a source from someone else to whom what they wrote does not apply. So that we have all these wonderful philosophies from these men of this generation, but then you also have Black people and women and Indigenous people who did not benefit from those things, recognized that they didn't benefit from those things, and in a lot of cases wrote it down.
Yeah, and that's the other thing of, people talk about, oh, well, that's quote unquote just multicultural history or whatever like that. It's like, no, that's history. You look in Massachusetts in 1777, who's writing a petition to the very legislature that is holding them enslaved? The enslaved people of Massachusetts. The evidence is there. It's been there. And to our great discredit, unfortunately, despite being informed, our curriculum has not reflected that. But that's changing, and I'm happy to be a part of that. I will add as a note, in terms of Manhattan, again, we think of Manhattan today as such a cosmopolitan place. But Manhattan, as you know, was the center of the slave trading industry in that area, ruthless. And there was a proposed, it was rumored to be a rebellion both of poor whites and enslaved people. And when they finally punished, I think it was like, it was over 50 people that were executed, and 13 African-American men were burned alive at the stake in Manhattan in, I believe it was the early 1770s. I mean, again, we have to realize that this was a national, economic, cruel, dehumanizing, torturous, inhumane system that resulted in these inhumane actions. I mean, 13 people burned alive.
That makes my skin crawl just thinking about it.
Of course, of course. And I, you know, I know your audience, and on one hand, I don't want to be overly inflammatory. On the other hand, it's important to claim all that, particularly because I think we're getting back into this era of, well, of course, we know all the Southern plantation owners did wrong, which they did, and rightfully should be decried. But we also need to look at the national economy that that fueled. And that's important. Right. Manhattan was at the center of the slave trade then because it was profitable.
And we can't hide from it. We can't run from it. And I'm of the opinion as an educator, the sooner we face it, the sooner we'll be able to face the problems that continue because of that system and hopefully eradicate those because we're better educated.
From your mouth to God's ears, may it be so. May God will it so.
Celinda, we are almost out of time, but I wanted to end with a parting thought from you. What do you think is the most important takeaway about, and this is a big, broad question. So the most important takeaway about either James Madison, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, or anything that teachers really should be telling their students?
Well, I will say that I've had a crisis of faith as a constitutional scholar the last few years. And it's not because of a particular political candidate winning or losing. It's because I feel like so many of my fellow citizens at various walks of life don't seem to believe in the rule of law anymore. And if we can't hold our public officials accountable for the things they do wrong, I'm really very sad. And I think sometimes grief is the way to approach it. The attack on the Capitol was, I just can't tell you how deep that cut to my heart. And I think it should cut to every American's heart. I cannot imagine that people would say that those who were behind it and fostered it and fomented it and wanted it to be disregarded. I believe very much in Representative Liz Cheney now, that this is the time to be accountable. And so if we can't be accountable on that, how can we say we really believe in a Constitution and Bill of Rights? I honestly believe that. And I've spent a long career at working. My books are designed not to tell people what to think. I have my own opinions, but I don't want to include those in my books. It's designed to give evidence for people to make up their own minds of all ages and all walks of life. But if we can't come together as a nation and say the people that attacked the Capitol on January 6th are wrong, need to be punished, and anyone who participates in it needs to be held accountable. I honestly can't imagine what's going to happen to our country, because then we don't believe in the Constitution. We don't.
And that's where our role begins. Talking with our youngest citizens about what rule of law is and what our Constitution means. Thank you so much, Linda, for joining me. I enjoyed this conversation immensely, and I would talk to you all night if if I could.
You and me too. Do I have time to add one other quick thing?
Please.
And it's connected to what I said before. I mean, my mission statement I discovered when I was in Harvard Law School in the spring of 1983. And it's that quote from Judge Learned Hand that I include in all my books, which is, you know, we put our hopes too much in laws and courts and constitutions. These are false hopes. Believe me, these are false hopes. Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. And when it dies there, no law, no court, no constitution can save it. That's been my mission statement. It's still my mission statement. And I hope everyone in your audience will take it as their mission statement too.
I love that. I'm going to hang that up in my classroom this year.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again, Linda. And for everyone in our audience, please visit lindamonk.com. Check out her website. Please purchase her books. They are incredible for your students and for your classrooms. Again, that's The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution, Ordinary Americans, U.S. History Through the Eyes of Everyday People, and my personal favorite, The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. If you would like to get in touch with Linda after this podcast is over, make sure you visit lindamonk.com so that you can contact her. If you'd like to contact me, again, find me on Twitter at History Her Way or on Instagram at Teaching History Her Way. And as always, thank you so very, very much for coming and for listening. I hope you've learned something today. I learned a whole ton, and I will talk to you next time. Have a wonderful week.